And welcome, Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're going to talk about the International Criminal Court and where it's going with Dr. David Hoyle, and he has just published an article in the Washington Times with the title, "The International Criminal Court Pursues Only Africans," which is undeniably so, and we're going to ask him about how that has come to be. And later we will also talk with Judy Havens. That's Professor Judy Havens, and she is in Halifax, and Judy Havens is a member of the Independent Jewish Voices Canada, the Halifax chapter, and teaches at St. Mary's University. She has published an article in the Halifax Media Co-op site, and I urge everybody to go there, objecting to the lack of balance from the Canadian political parties and the silence, basically, of Parliament about the bombing, the attack on Gaza. And so we're going to be talking to her about that. But we are joined now by Dr. David Hoyle. Are you there, sir?
Yes, indeed, Phil. How are you?
Very good. I should remind everybody right at the top that, of course, we spoke to you not so long ago because you have published a new book, a very important one, Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court, the Africa Research Center. By the way, that's available. People go online. You can read this book. It's 600 pages of very decent scholarship, I would say. But now, most recently, you've taken note of the visit to Washington of various African leaders. They had a kind of a high-profile meeting with President Obama. And you made the point, and here's the subtitle, Injustice in Africa, the International Criminal Court Pursues Only Africans. And you were... I don't know if you believe they were going to raise this or you were urging them to raise it, but in any event, why should they be talking about the International Criminal Court with President Obama?
Well, the actual meeting was the first ever summit between an American president and African leaders. So it was quite a unique event. And I think it wasn't actually officially on the schedule or the program, but I have no doubt at all that the issue of the International Criminal Court was raised, and raised for many, many reasons. I think, first of all, the ICC is a European baby, either by conception or adoption. So, in fact, it functions as an instrument of European foreign policy.
By the way, maybe there's a mystery father. Would that be the United States?
I don't think so. I think if you trace the origin of the ICC back, you know, the Washington actually did its best to kill it at birth. So I think it's not being one of the parents of this organization. It may well actually from time to time use it when it actually perceives it's in Washington's best interest. Mm-hmm. So, and this again is the irony of the whole thing. You have an African-American president who is actually demanding that Africans send their citizens to a European court, largely funded, largely controlled by the European colonial masters of Africa, yet at the same time, that president has made it very clear that this is such a incompetent court, such a political court, that no American citizen will ever appear before it.
Yes, and that's kind of, on both parties, they've agreed. They're not going to ever let an American go there.
In fact, I mean, there was the, there were actually one or two bits of legislation passed under the Bush administration, which we actually jokingly refer to as the Hague Invasion Act, which is if an American was ever before the court in The Hague, the Washington would actually invade invade The Hague to get him or her back. So, yeah, I mean...
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, I mean...
Leaving no doubt about their position.
So, you know, the African leadership actually were there. There's no doubt that the Bush administration and the Obama administration have actually used other courts, as I mentioned, whenever it's actually been convenient for them, as a means of serving their foreign policy. And these issues were raised. In fact, I know they were raised because you had the irony, for example, of immediately before the last Kenyan election, in which one or two people who were invited by the ICC were candidates, where Washington said, you know, we will not have anything at all to do with anyone who's indicted, not convicted yet, but just indicted before the court. And then, of course, they were elected by the Kenyan people. Now, this meant that President Obama and his team had to meet people who actually at this moment in time are indicted and appearing before the ICC in Washington itself. I mean, for example, President Kenyatta. So it was obviously very uncomfortable for the Americans and probably also very uncomfortable for one or two of the American, one or two of the African heads of state.
I have to ask you, did Mr. Kenyatta, was he part of this African group that went to Washington?
Yes, he was. A very prominent part of that group.
I can recall, though, they were talking about arresting him if he traveled. So I guess if you go to see the President of the United States, there's a kind of a little a pass.
Well, sorry, you had the American ambassador in Kenya literally on the eve of the election saying, you know, you have to be very, very careful who you elect, because we are not going to have anything to do with anyone who's elected, or in fact, who's even a candidate, if they have been indicted by the ICC. And of course, then the ambassador and by default Washington had to eat their words, when in fact the Kenyan people did elect these candidates.
It could probably be argued that might have been one of the reasons, right?
Well, I think there's no doubt about it. Which country, which self-respecting nation would actually accept foreign interference and foreign threats in terms of who they elect as their leaders? I think Washington was on a hiding to nothing actually from the start in that sense. But there you had it. You had virtually all of the American, all of the African leadership in Washington, and as mentioned, you know, the first ever African American president meeting them. So it was a great opportunity, I think, to voice a number of the grievances which these African leaders actually have had about the court. The court, you know, hasn't done a huge amount to actually justify itself, except actually a exclusive focus on African leaders and the African continent. Mm-hmm. Every single one of their cases so far indicted or brought to trial have been from Africa. So the Africans have a grievance about that and are feeling very uneasy about this a one-sided focus.
Well, this is Dr. David Hoyle, but he is the author of Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court, and that's published at the African Research Center, 2014. You can get a copy of that, and he's written an article recently published in the Washington Star, Injustice in Africa. You say, David, that the Africans went along with the promise that we're going to have international justice. And now, obviously, they have their doubts about all this. Are they examining the details that you lay out in your book? This is a court which is so politicized, and frankly, rather corrupt. I think you mentioned that there is a judge was chosen from Japan for unknown reasons. It's apparently the only one that anybody could put their finger on was that she spoke English.
Well, she, I mean...
she's not actually a judge.
Well, that's right. The irony of this court is that given that it is charged with examining and actually passing judgment on some of the world's most serious crimes and often most difficult crimes to actually judge, most of the judges who have been appointed have never been judges, and in some cases many of them actually haven't even been lawyers, so they've never actually appeared in a courtroom before their appointment.
That sounds, in ordinary parlance, it indicates they might be friends of politicians.
It's Kafkaesque, yes. I mean, the Japanese judge was appointed. I mean, she was a diplomat. She had neither a degree in law or any training or background in law whatsoever, apart from actually having been a Japanese ambassador, I think, to Iceland and one or two of the...
That's halfway to the bar right there.
Well, yeah. And the only reason she was appointed was because she could speak English. Apparently, many of the judges in Japan, you know, who may have actually served, weren't able to speak English or French actually to the level required. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, of course, is that she was appointed as a judge in the same year. In fact, a few months after. Japan joined the ICC actually, and gave the biggest single contribution that any country can make to the ICC a budget that year. So, you know,
a mysterious door opened to the inner sanctum.
That's right. But
I wonder who pushes the button and looks out the window to see who's knocking.
That actually brings on to the other issue, of course, which is that these judges are. Not appointed because they're the best legal minds. Obviously not in the case of the other judges.
Yeah, having no legal mind at all.
Unfortunately, in this case, they are appointed in effect through vote trading. Now, vote trading is a very corrupt but very hallowed function of the United Nations, which is if your country exercises its vote to vote for another country's a preferred candidate on, for example, the Law of the Sea Tribunal or any range of the jobs out in the sort of international arena. That country may then actually vote for your candidate and for the ICC or another body like that. So the ICC itself and even all the groups that are very, very sympathetic to the ICC have identified this as a persistent and consistent a problem with the ICC. Vote trading produces mediocrity. It doesn't actually produce excellence. And this, again, has been one of the hallmarks of most, if not all, the people who have been appointed as judges. Many of them are washed-up politicians. Many of them are people who the governments who actually are appointing them want out of the country. For whatever reason, but one thing they are not is real judges as often as not.
By the way, some of them need washing up, I gather. This is Dr. David Hoyle, and his article is Injustice in Africa, and the International Criminal Court pursues only Africans, and that is simply cannot be disputed. David, let's talk about the money. We all understand that people who pay the piper often call the tune. Who provides the money to the ICC?
Well, at this moment in time, something like two-thirds of the funding for the ICC comes from the European Union, and most of it are the biggest five funders are actually paradoxically or rather concerningly, they are the big five former colonial powers in Africa. So it's France, it's Britain, it's Germany, it's Italy, and Spain. These are the biggest funders of the ICC, which in effect, you know, by default makes the ICC a European, you know, baby, a European experiment. I would say a European instrument of foreign policy.
Yeah. By the way, in your book, I believe you point out that Germany at one point clearly said they, since they gave a certain amount, they expected a certain number of people to get jobs. And then apparently there was a kind of a little back channel conversation, and they dropped. They said, "You don't have to say that publicly."
that's exactly what happened. And in fact, the person who wrote that article for one of these internal German diplomatic magazines was himself then appointed. Although he was a diplomat, was then appointed as a ICC judge. So it's
so I have some prospects. I have a shot at being a judge at the ICC.
Well, to be honest, I think you'd make an infinitely better judge because of a common sense and realism.
So that would be
any
a problem
other judges
there.
who are there. You've had one or two judges. I mean, the main case which the ICC actually has had historically was the Lubanga case of Thomas Lubanga from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, who was actually charged with recruiting child soldiers in the Congo. Now, he actually first came into ICC custody in 2006. The case is still not finished. It's in the appeal stage. So this man has actually been in custody for all that time. And
presumed innocent, of course.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons actually for the length of time he's been in custody is that the case itself was horrendously messed up. There were sort of prosecutorial irregularities. There were attempts to actually bring in new charges halfway through the other case. And one of the very few real judges on the ICC is a British judge. And on two separate occasions, he tried to end the case. He said, we can no longer guarantee this man a free and fair trial. Mm-hmm. And on two separate occasions, other judges in the appeal chamber, the appeal section of that court, who were, I think, actually far less up to the job than he was, ruled against him. So, you know, where you have had a good judge, or a real judge, mm-hmm. you know, he's been outvoted, you know, by the sort of mediocrities, often for, I would say, actually political or institutional reasons.
Yeah. Yes, he's overqualified. this is
right.
Dr. David Hoyle. And by the way, I'm going to make sure people know the title and go to this site. It's Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court, the Africa Research Center 2014, 600 and some odd pages. And there's another matter that you raise in your book, and which bears on this thing of why the African leaders are right to say they don't want this process to go forward, and that's the private donor. There seem to be money that comes in to support the court, if I read your book, read it properly, which is not quite accounted for as to where that's coming from. And since that raises the issue of conflict, the way it was resolved is that they made them promise that they wouldn't interfere if they gave the money. Did I get that right? Did I dream that?
That is right. That was actually one of the sort of interesting new aspects which was inherited from the model of the International Criminal Court for the former Yugoslavia, where again you had to basically anybody could, you know, try and fund the ICE that court, and by default also this court. So at the end of the day, it's not a huge amount of funding, and I think it's actually been eclipsed. It's a massively eclipsed by the funding coming from the European Union and other mm-hmm. countries. So, but yes,
that door actually hasn't been closed and locked.
No.
And that strange language, I mean, that's like American politics, the anti-lobbyist business, where they say, oh, he promised not to try to influence anybody. He just said he wanted to meet the senator.
That's right. That's right. Well, I mean, yes, well, that is actually one of the ironies of the whole thing.
By the way, we don't know who they are, do we?
No, no. They are never actually are mentioned in the...
I'm sure they're wonderful people.
...at the end of the budget. Well, who could tell us? One of the other ironies, of course, is that, you know, you have the full spectrum in terms of a consistent viewpoint on the ICC. I mean, you've had American Supreme Court justices all the way down to the Zimbabwean Minister of Justice actually referring to the court as a kangaroo court.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the actual consensus on this issue outside of Europe is actually quite amazing, really. I mean, it's hard to know where to begin and where to end in terms of...
Yeah. Yeah, by the way, it sounds like something that ought to just be permitted to collapse. But I have to... Another feature that I want to make sure I ask you about, and that is that... Because I use that old-fashioned expression from common law, I guess, presumption of innocence. If third parties say, you shouldn't have arrested that man, he's innocent, that didn't happen... Or it didn't happen the way your prosecutor says. The prosecutor has threatened people who say that.
Well, the first chief prosecutor who was from the Argentine actually made this extraordinary outburst. I think it was 2008 or 2009. He'd given a report at the United Nations on the process and progress, or lack of progress, in effect, mm-hmm. of the ICC, and he referred to the president of Sudan, who has been indicted, but obviously not brought to any trial because he's refused to acknowledge the ICC as a legitimate court. Mm-hmm. And the UN ambassador of Sudan actually had the audacity, as far as a prosecutor was concerned, to say, "Well, actually, wait a while. He's not been convicted. He's innocent." Mm. And the ICC chief prosecutor said that he was going to investigate a way of actually criminalizing that sort of a comment, i.e., are making it illegal to say that somebody who has been indicted may actually be innocent. Now, of course, at the end of the day, obviously, you know, some of the real lawyers around him, and he does have some Anglo-Saxon lawyers around him, coming from the Anglo-Saxon mm-hmm. legal background, said, "Well, you can't really do this. This is not a thing you can actually say." And of course, that whole issue actually was dropped. But the threat was very clear.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot state that somebody indicted by the ICC was innocent. If you did so,
I think Orwell says that's a thought crime, and take a chance with people thinking.
Well, that's right. You know, I think the Orwell comment is spot on, and a court is, or this institution. I mean, I don't think it's like you can really call it a court, but it's a bit like the Emperor Has No Clothes meets Alice in Wonderland meets Kafka. I mean, it's one of the, I think, as you said, I mean, it really should not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the years to come, hopefully, it'll actually fade away a bit like the League of Nations.
Yes, that really worked out. We're speaking to Dr. David Oil, and I want to make sure I get your last line in this, the article, the Washington Times, because you say it's time that Africans stop paying the price of European legal adventurism on its continent. By the way, it's been about a decade of it, and some of that adventurism is running into serious turbulence, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, many of my friends in Africa have actually described, you know, our diocese as the European colonialism by legal diktat, which is that if there are leaders in Africa who don't actually toe the line, the ICC will be deployed against them, or at the very least, it will be actually threatened that should be used against them. And the former president of the Ivory Coast, I think, Mr. Gbagbo, was one of those people. I think, I mean, in 2000, I think it was actually in 2003, 2004, even then, he was actually taking a very independent a view of things in Africa's the position and the Ivory Coast's position with regards actually to France. And the then French president actually warned him and said, well, you know, if you don't toe the line, in effect, you may find yourself actually for the ICC. And
where he now is.
Lo and behold, actually several years later, that's exactly what happened. He is now one of the people indicted and in custody in The Hague. So
yes,
it's quite extraordinary.
Yes. By the way, since Gaza is in the news, and I noticed that people are calling on the Palestinian Authority to go to the ICC, you know, I'd have to, based on your book and your articles, I think I'd have to suggest to them that really wouldn't be a wise course. They ought to go to a proper court. And there is one, isn't there, between states? I mean, when the U.S. was mining the harbors in Nicaragua, the world... something called the World Court, which it seems to be real, manned by actual judges, and they said the Americans were criminally at fault or wrong. Wouldn't that be a better venue for this issue?
Well, the court in question is the International Court of Justice, and it's existed for many decades, and it is in effect the World Court. There's no doubt about it. Obviously, to an extent, it is actually political. A bit, but not in any way, you know, to the degree that the ICC is. And this is a court that has, you know, has some bottom, it has some clout, and it's got, you know, some consistency with it as well. So that's one avenue, I think, actually, for that particular conflict that to be examined. The ICC is not the right forum for this. Mm-hmm. In any way, and I'll give you one example. The European Union mandates all its members to, at every single opportunity, argue the case for ICC membership. In fact, to press for ICC membership, and the European Union actually links to trade and aid to ICC membership in third world countries. Uh-huh. Interestingly enough, last year, when Palestine was accorded non-member observer state status at the United Nations, and in effect was recognized as a state, the first thing which a country like France and Germany and Britain did was they said, "Do not join the ICC. In fact, if you join the ICC, we will actually, you know, I look upon this very negatively, and will actually probably also withdraw some of our funding from the Palestinian Authority. Specifically because they knew that if a Palestine joined the ICC, at some stage in time, Israel would come into the frame in terms of a complaint. So, you know, once again shows you how politics actually permeates, you know, every single aspect of that court and every single aspect of the European approach to that court. So, do not join this court at all if you are Palestinian. But every other country is actually actively encouraged to join the court as far as Europe's concerned.
Wow,
it's a plaything.
A most helpful analysis. We've been speaking to Dr. David Hoyle. His article in the Washington Post, Injustice in Africa, and of course the book is Justice Denied, the reality of the International Criminal Court. That, and you can find that at the Africa Research Center 2014. It's a great indictment, Dr. Hoyle. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. It was a labor of love.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's Dr. David Hoyle. And the problems of this wonderful term, justice. You know, I was in a cemetery once in Chicago, and I saw the grave of a gangster. And on his stone, he had written, "I want justice." And I don't blame him. He probably did want justice. He probably had all kinds of problems that had nothing to do with you know, how he ended up. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and Phil Conlon has an announcement. We're going to be speaking shortly with Judy Haven.
Yes, Richard Williams, who is the father of Venus and Serena Williams and is a famous tennis coach, of course, has written a memoir, Black and White, The Way I See It, and Monday, August 18th at 5:30 p.m., that's a week from tonight, he'll be appearing at a different book list at 746 Bathurst Street. And he will also appear, and there will also be a reception as well, the following night as well, Tuesday, August the 19th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Miller Lash House, 130 Kingston Road in Scarborough. And copies of the book will be available for the special price of $25. Well worth buying and well worth meeting Richard Williams. Next Monday, August 18th, at a different book list, and Tuesday, August 19th at 6:30 at Miller Lash House, 130 Kingston Road.
Well, thank you very much, Phil. This is the Taylor Report, and you can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM, Facebook / The Taylor Report.